This podcast was recorded on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We acknowledge and pay our respect to their elders past and present. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are warned that the following episode contains voices of people who are deceased.
Anyway, wild things should be free.
It definitely feels like one of those movies that was always around me and in my orbit kind of growing up, even though I don't have a singular memory of sitting down and watching it.
He's come back! Daddy's come back! Mr. Percival's come back!
We're being asked to see things through Storm Boy's eyes, and he represents a new generation, where he's in encountering these really deep historical legacies of colonisation, of hunters and their treatment of birds that he is finding really difficult to grapple with.
In an isolated coastal wilderness known as the Coorong, a young boy called Mike comes across three orphaned pelican chicks.
Storm Boy.
Aided by his friend, Fingerbone Bill, he raises them to adults, but then his father insists he release them.
The birds are going back tomorrow.
Reluctantly, he lets them free.
About time they did.
But one pelican returns. Mike names him Mr. Percival. Together, the two forge an unlikely bond, sharing in activities like sailing and playing catch. But trouble soon comes in the form of duck shooters, who fire with abandon at anything with wings and wreak havoc on the landscape. Colin Tilley's 1964 novel Storm Boy is etched into Australia's consciousness. The book has appeared in countless school curricula, engaging young people on themes around caring for animals and protecting precious ecosystems. It's been turned into two feature films and has inspired numerous stage adaptations. I'm Dylan Bird, and this is Seeing Green, a podcast exploring how Australian cinema has shaped our relationship to our natural environment. In this episode, we're re-examining director Henri Safran's acclaimed 1976 film adaptation of Storm Boy. We explore whether the film's environmental messages still have application today, and consider why the story has continued to resonate more than half a century since it first appeared. To help guide the way, I'm joined by two experts from different fields. First up, Senior Lecturer in Film and Screen Studies at Swinburne University of Technology, Dr. Jess Balanzategi, whose work focuses on children's screen cultures and genres. Hi, Jess. Thanks so much for coming aboard Seeing Green.
Hi, Dylan. Thanks for having me.
And so tell us more about your research background and interests.
My research covers two quite different terrains that are actually intersecting, but a lot of people might think they are intersecting. As you said, it covers children's media, so film and television in particular for children, but also featuring child characters and child performers. And I also focus on, as an area of specialty and interest, horror and gothic screen genres. And that includes horror and gothic kind of film and TV for children, which does actually exist, but also horror and gothic genres for adults. So yeah, those are my two distinct but sometimes intersecting areas of expertise. And Storm Boy, I think, in some interesting ways brings those together.
Fantastic. Well, we're very lucky to have you as part of this episode, Jess. And our second expert is Associate Professor Emily O'Gorman from Macquarie University, whose work focuses on environmental history. Emily has published research specifically on the Coorong and the broader Murray-Darling Basin, including her 2021 book, Wetlands in a Dry Land. Emily, great to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks, Dylan. Great to be here.
And so tell us more about your research background.
Yeah, so for quite a few years, I've focused on the relationships between people and water in the Murray-Darling Basin. So I've looked at people's changing relationships with floods, and then more recently with wetlands in the Murray-Darling Basin, and trying to connect those with global events and themes. And part of my work on wetlands has really looked at the way people's relationships with animals also shape the way they use and value wetlands. So I've looked at wetlands as more than human spaces, as well as human spaces.
And why the Murray-Darling Basin? What led you to focusing on that particular region for some of your research?
Well, I actually, during my honours year, which it was up in Queensland at University of Queensland, I became really interested in rivers, and I was thinking about the Brisbane River. This is, of course, before the big, more recent flood that happened along the river. But I lived along the river, and I was interested in people's relationships with it. And I actually started researching that river, and then I pulled out a rainfall map of Queensland, and down in the southwest corner, noticed this very erratic rainfall pattern happening. And I actually got interested in the Murray-Darling Basin through those the Queensland branches of the Darling River. And then I just followed them down. So I ended up doing my PhD on the Murray-Darling Basin, and I've come to sort of know and love different parts of that region, and one of those is the Coorong, where I've spoken to lots of different people down there, and yeah, there's a real love and passion for that place by the people that live there.
And very nice to have you as part of today's episode, given you grew up next to a waterway as well, which of course is the case for Mike in Stormboy too. Fantastic. Well, we're very lucky to have you as part of today's episode as well, Emily. Jess, do you remember when you first engaged with Stormboy, either in book or film form?
I don't really remember clearly when I first encountered Stormboy. I feel like it was the kind of media that was always there around me somehow in childhood. So Stormboy has had, I think, a big cultural impact because it's been adopted in educational curricula. So the book by Colin Teal that the film is based on has also, I think, been taught a lot in schools. So I have these kind of hazy memories of Stormboy and the cover of different versions of the book. I think posters or the cover of different video and DVD kind of versions of the film, and these images in my mind from like key images from the film with Mike and Mr. Percival, without a clear memory of ever kind of sitting down and watching it. So yeah, it definitely feels like one of those movies that was always around me and in my orbit kind of growing up in North Queensland is where I grew up. Even though I don't have a singular memory of sitting down and watching it. So I guess that's testament to the impact of this particular film in Australian kind of kids' culture.
Absolutely. And I think that's probably a familiar experience. I can remember, I think, a grade four teacher reading it aloud to us and shrieking Mr. Percival, which is still kind of etched in my core in some way or another. On the look of the film, it's interesting to hear that you can still, you know, you grew up remembering or recalling some of these seminal scenes. How would you describe the way that the film looks visually and the way that it feels too?
It's such a beautiful film, and it has so, and it's really, I think it highlights it when you compare it to the 2019 remake, just how much time and space is given in the original film to the Coorong and the landscape and Stormboy's place in that landscape, and these amazing wide shots and kind of long takes of him just kind of lingering by the side of the ocean, lingering on the jetty, looking out at the ocean, lingering in these spaces where ocean kind of turns into river. So a lot of time and space given in the 1976 film to these amazing images. So I think the film has this almost kind of elemental, mystical power to it because of the emphasis that's placed on those images, which unfortunately the 2019 version probably doesn't achieve to the same extent because it's packed with so many characters and so many extra kind of plot elements, whereas the 1976 film is so simple in its narrative and so kind of laser focused on these three characters, that the triad of Stormboy, his father Hideaway Tom, and Fingerbone Bill, this indigenous young man that Stormboy kind of encounters on the Coorong. It's so laser focused on those three and their kind of existence in this landscape that we really just get to kind of observe and hang out in these spaces with them. So I think that's why those kind of images, maybe not even any specific or particular image, just really, I guess, leave an impression on my mind. because I definitely can clearly remember those images of the character of Storm Boy and Mr. Percival kind of walking along the beach, or Storm Boy kind of navigating the river systems on his little raft.
And Emily, you're someone who has hung out at the Coorong for field work. What was your experience of that place, and how does that compare with the way that it's represented, I suppose primarily in the 1976 film, but also in the more recent remake as well?
I have to agree with Jessica that I think the 1976 film did such a fabulous job of trying to capture that landscape, which I think is actually really important for the story, and it resonates a lot with this coming of age story. So it's a very difficult landscape, I can imagine, to try and represent on film. It's like the scale is really hard to capture, I think, on a screen. So it's this long lagoon. The Coorong is this long lagoon, which is separated from the ocean by this long set of sand dunes, Young Husband Peninsula, with the rough Southern Ocean on the other side. So there's these two bodies of water, the calm body of the lagoon and then this rough ocean, and then this mobile sand dune in the middle that's movable. And I think that is really poignant for the story, which is about a coming of age story, and it's about change. It's about sort of legacies, long legacies, and staying still, and then also about change and how that can happen. And in this landscape of change that's so mobile, like the mouth of the Murray, of course, connects the Coorong and the Southern Ocean, and where the mouth is at any given time, if it's open to the ocean, is different. So it moves around. So it's this extremely mobile landscape, and one of sort of extremes in a way, with the calm and the rough as well. Yeah, so I think it's really important landscape for the story, and I think the 76 film did such a great job of trying to bring that into the story, and the connection between Storm Boy and the landscape was done so beautifully.
Your research explores human perceptions of the environment and narratives of the environment and so on. I'm wondering whether you brought anything from watching Storm Boy to your research or your first encounter with that particular place. I mean, were some of those images in your mind when you went there to do field work?
Similar to Jessica, I had these vague impressions from my own childhood of Storm Boy, but I was a very impatient child and found it very difficult to sit and patiently watch like such a delicate movie that it is, and very subtle and nuanced. And so I was actually doing some research in the State Archives in Adelaide, and I came across this really big file, which was about a pelican slaughter that happened on the pelican breeding colonies in the Coorong in 1911. There was a lot of different groups implicated in that story, including ornithologists trying to protect the birds. There were fishermen who saw pelicans as a pest. There was also hunters involved, who, because part of it was a game reserve, which offered some protection to the pelicans during their breeding season, and so on. So I had started reading those archives, and I was writing about it, and I thought, I'm doing more work on the Coorong. I'm going to watch Storm Boy again. And I watched it, and I saw so many resonances with what I was finding in the archives from a slightly earlier time, and it was really interesting to think about those legacies into the 60s and 70s as well, with protected areas and the legacies of game reserves and hunting traditions on the Coorong, with issues around Aboriginal people's exclusion from protected areas, and of course the history of fishing in the area.
Yeah, and that 1911 pelican slaughter that you've published academic work on really highlights some of those tensions between different groups, as you just mentioned, and very interesting in light of some of the themes explored in Storm Boy and some of the plot points as well. There's a scene in the film where Hideaway Tom and Storm Boy find Fingerbone to warn him that the ranger is on his tail. This is after Fingerbone shot to scare off some hoons who had torn up the dunes in buggies the night before. And so Hideaway tells Tom that there's a law against shacking or camping in the Coorong, to which Fingerbone replies, "Whitefella's law." So implying that for him, it's perfectly natural to live there and to live in harmony with nature.
Yeah, there's a law against people shacking in the sanctuary. He might tell you to move on.
This country belonged to him?
Maybe not. The law says you can't stay.
Whitefella's law.
This film came at a time, and the book as well, where the Aboriginal land rights movement was really gaining traction. Jess, I'm interested in whether this film was unique in the way in which it dealt with some of those issues and explored, I suppose, this changing cultural mindset in Australia that gave more prominence to self-determination compared to what came before, particularly in relation to First Nations issues.
I think the whole film is dedicated to exploring these different and to some extent clashing kind of regimes of knowledge and law, kind of legal constructs. And as you were kind of explaining so beautifully, Emily, that the landscape, the environment in the film is so critical to the depiction of that story. So all of the characters, to some extent, that these three main characters are in these kind of liminal places, kind of in the fringes or between social groups and versions of society. So Fingerbone Bill has been kind of cast out of his own community, which is why he's living alone on the Coorong, and he's obviously not kind of living in accordance with Whitefella law either, so he's kind of between there. Hideaway Tom as well has kind of rejected this normative white Anglo-Australian life. He's not integrated into society and he wants it that way. He doesn't even want a radio brought into the home when Storm Boy finds one on the beach and wants to bring it home. And Storm Boy himself, which obviously he's the focus of the film, he is at this liminal stage of his childhood where he has to make a decision. Is he going to stay on the Coorong, grow up there and reject a traditional kind of white Australian education, or is he going to kind of go and become integrated into society by going to school and leaving the Pelicans and Fingerbone Bill and his father and that kind of, their kind of ocean shack behind?
How would you respond to that, Emily?
So I guess I was seeing it with my historical lens on or eyes on, and I was thinking about it as a coming of age story for Australia. So I was seeing it as we're being asked to see things through Storm Boy's eyes, and he represents a new generation, where he's in encountering these really deep historical legacies of colonisation, of conflict between white Anglo Australia and Aboriginal Australia, of hunters and their treatment of birds that he is finding really difficult to grapple with, all these conflicts, and which all have these really long historical legacies, and he's encountering them. Or the way that we're seeing him encountering them is almost for the first time. And as a sort of representative of a new generation of Australia, I feel like we're being asked to see that there's another way. So he's grappling with these legacies, but also trying to find his own way, and that there can be a different way. He can have his own relationship with Fingerbone. He can find new ways of relating to animals. He can encounter different worldviews and do things differently.
Yeah, I love that idea. And near the beginning of the film, Storm Boy says, "I got a gun, Dad, gonna start killing things," after I think the first time he's hung out with Fingerbone Bill. And it almost feels like that's where he's at a crossroads. He can go down the route of, you know, all these sort of toxic men who are running around hunting, shooting things and messing up the sand dunes and destroying property, or learn to live more in harmony with nature, caring for animals and coexisting, I suppose, in much more of a harmonious way.
Got a gun. A big one, Dad. Might start killing things.
There's also been, of course, a remake done just in the past few years of Storm Boy, a new film. How do you view the way that that deals with the story, and in what way does that reflect any changing environmental consciousness, given the greater awareness today about the dangers of climate change and what's happened to the Coorong in the sort of 30, 40, 50 years since the story first emerged? What's your sense of that, Jess?
The 1976 version, as I said, it as a coming-of-age story, it kind of really thrives in that liminality in a way that's sometimes almost kind of unnerving. It does engage with, I highlighted it very briefly before, but engages in some ways with the style of these arty dramas that were coming out in the 1970s, other films like Picnic at Hanging Rock, Wake in Fright and Walkabout, which all came a few years before Storm Boy, which have this kind of gothic, tense edge to them. And I feel like Storm Boy, even though it's a children's film and definitely wouldn't usually be described as an Australian gothic film, it has elements of that tension in this commitment to liminality. And I feel like that edge is completely taken out of the 2019 remake because all those kind of life paths that I was talking about, there's no sense of uncertainty or liminality in those, that we kind of see the path that Storm Boy has chosen. He's chosen to grow up and become Michael. He's left the Storm Boy name behind and he's a businessman, former counsellor in a suit played by Jeffrey Rush in his 60s or 70s, kind of looking back on life and the decisions he's made, and he's living in a mansion and he's got a helicopter and he's been to Singapore to get some kind of exotic lollies that he's sharing with his colleagues in the opening scene. That's weirdly how he's introduced as this kind of, I guess, hyper-capitalist man of the world. So we know really early on in that film the path that he's chosen, and it's the path that Storm Boy is kind of contemplating rejecting, I guess, in the 1976 version. It reminded me of in the 1976 version how when Storm Boy tries to bring the radio home and his dad says that will kind of fill your head with rubbish because it'll just make you want more and more and more and more things, and you'll fill your life with rubbish. And we see in the 2019 version that's exactly the path that Michael seems to have chosen. So it kind of does take the edge out of that liminality of the coming of age story in the 1976 version, but at the same time I can see how that also works in interesting ways through the framing that Emily was talking about. If you think of the story more on a kind of socio-cultural and collective level, kind of reflecting back on how we've advanced since the 70s when it comes to ecological concerns and indigenous relations and how far we've got to go, I suppose. So I think the two films maybe work best as companion pieces, it'd be interesting to see what you think about that, Emily.
What's your sense of how the two films compare, Emily?
Yeah, as Jessica was saying, that socio-cultural level was sort of how I was thinking about it. And so I saw it as Michael had grown up and representative perhaps of that generation that also fought for environmental protection and that sort of thing so powerfully in the 70s and also was raised by that generation, I suppose, thinking about the age of Storm Boy at that age, had sort of forgotten the things they had learnt. So we now find ourselves in a situation globally of grappling with climate change. And also, in Australia, issues around mining, water, so on. And I've actually been reading archives from the 70s as well. And the things that were happening then seem environmentally really super progressive compared to what's happening now. So I saw the film as a prod towards, older generations to remember the lessons that they might have learnt from the 60s and 70s, but also that might be, remembering that might be a way of connecting with the younger generation that is so powerfully advocating for change in the face of climate changes.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jess, I'm interested to get your thoughts on the depiction of Fingerbone Bill, particularly in the 1976 version of the film. Throughout Australian arts, literature, film, TV and so on, there has been sort of a quite fraught the way that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have been depicted, from a complete absence to perhaps too close an alignment with nature that might remove agency entirely. What's your sense of Fingerbone Bill's depiction in the 1976 film?
Yes, I think these issues around appropriate, empowering, respectful, accurate representations of Indigenous characters and ways of life, I don't think they have really diminished at all in Australian film and television. And obviously, to a 2022 audience watching the 1976 film, there are problems that hit you in the face. The way that Fingerbone Bill, played so beautifully by David Gulpilil, is introduced, for instance, that watching the film again for the podcast after not having seen it for a long time, I was so struck by the way he's introduced as almost scary in his blackness. So the way Storm Boy kind of finds his camp where he's living, and he kind of, Fingerbone Bill, creeps around the tree, and we get this juddering close-up suddenly of his face, and Storm Boy is kind of horrified originally.
What you doing here, boy? You painting something? Now what happened when little fella tell lies? Spirit man, Tadakul come at night and take him away. Now sit down. I do some talking.
It's very problematic because there seems to be some baked-in assumption in the visual dynamics of that we would find a close-up of an Indigenous man's face frightening when it's set up that way. So that was particularly troubling and pretty characteristic, I suppose, of Indigenous representation in the 60s and 70s.
Oh, thanks so much, Jessica. That I couldn't agree more. And the other thing that really struck me is that the line, and I think it was Fingerbone's line in the 1970s movie, was given to Mike. Something like, Mr. Percival is a bird that never dies.
Perhaps Mr. Percival starting all over again. Bird like him never die.
And it was so beautiful in the 1970s movie. It's Fingerbone showing Storm Boy some baby birds, saying, look, there's another generation, there's a lot going on, there's kinship relationships, there's, you know, and it was this really poignant moment that encapsulated so many things, so many resonances. And then in the 2019 movie, it's Mike touching a statue of Mr. Percival, saying it's a bird that doesn't die. And it's just this individual representation of Mr. Percival as a statue rather than this intergenerational comment. So it was really different and I think much more beautiful in the 1970s movie.
Jess Belenza-Teggi, Emily O'Gorman, it's been so great having you as part of Seeing Green. It's been a really enlightening experience re-examining Storm Boy. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Dylan. It's great to chat, Emily.
Yeah, same. Likewise. I learned a lot.
Seeing Green is made at Swinburne University of Technology and Monash University and is supported by an Australian Research Council Discovery Grant. Our executive producers are Professor Therese Davis and Associate Professor Belinda Smale. Production and mixing by Britta Jorgensen. Music by Ash Sterling. And hosted by me, Dylan Bird. In the next episode of Seeing Green...
You know, all of the clichés and tropes of how horror movies sort of generate a reaction of fear, it does all of those.
We've kind of got David Attenborough's wildlife documentaries on one side, and then we've got the sort of the big animal sort of horror movies, and there's not that much really in the middle.